Welcome to Wildlife Rehabilitation from Rescue to Release, a podcast dedicated to licensed wildlife rehabilitators and the veterinarians who support them. I'm your host, Gail Buell.
Techniques we discuss here are meant for licensed wildlife professionals. If you aren't licensed and trained for wildlife rehabilitation, do not attempt to capture, hold, or rehabilitate any wild animal. If you find an injured wild animal, a wildlife professional can recommend next steps. We will tackle topics about rescue, care, management, reconditioning, and releasing wildlife found in North America. This is a deep dive into each subject. We hope to give rehabilitators information they can use because they're already going to great lengths to rescue and nurse animals back to health. There are three possible outcomes in wildlife rehabilitation: release, euthanasia, and placement. An injured or orphaned wild animal's journey to restored health and independence in their natural habitat is delicate and complex. We draw techniques and expertise from many disciplines. Many animals brought into rehabilitation cannot be saved. The last gift we can give them is humane euthanasia. We'll talk more about when this is necessary. Sometimes animals are deemed non-releasable and evaluated to be suitable for a life in captivity. When that happens, we shift to a long-term approach to managing their care, training, and housing. Some such animals serve as ambassador animals, a term for animals that rehabilitators use to educate the public. Each episode, we'll speak with experts who represent specialty topics across the profession of wildlife rehabilitation, ambassador animal care and management, showcasing best practices.
Hello, everyone. Today I'm back for part two of my discussion on striped skunks with Ruby Davis. Now, Ruby is the Wildlife Rehabilitation Director for the Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center. In case you missed part one, which was episode 7, we started out by covering Ruby's origin story and how she came to be in her current role. We also discussed the natural history of the striped skunk, that black and white animal that is common in North America. So now what we're going to talk about is we're going to get really in depth and in detail on skunk care and rehabilitation. And I thought we would start with, I was thinking orphans, because my guess is that of the number of skunks you get, that's going to be the highest proportion.
Correct.
Am I right?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And about how many skunks a year do you guys get at Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center?
We average about between 40 and 50 a year.
Okay, wow.
That does include adults too. It's funny, I was just running our stats for end of year reports, and actually I can pull those up for you and let you know a little bit more if you want.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. That's cool. We can do that.
But for us, majority of ours are orphans. And then, you know, we get the older ones that have encountered some sort of injury. But the orphans are one of the shorter rehabs with all the other mammals, I think, that we do, especially like your raccoons are longer, your fox rehab is longer, even your possum rehab is longer than skunk rehab. But, you know, they're not as short as bunnies. I love doing the bunnies. They're 4 weeks and you're done, right?
And you're done. They're out.
Yeah, exactly. So theirs is not as lengthy, but not as short as the bunnies either. So
Okay. So that's super helpful. And most of them are coming in, since most of them are coming to you when they're found outside of their den.
Yes.
So midsummer? Early summer?
Yeah, we start getting a flux of skunks usually around May. And May into June. Now, this year we did have a litter, it was two, come in later in the season, which was unusual. It was the latest I had received baby skunks, and that was in September. I've never seen baby skunks that late. Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
But we start getting them pretty steady, you know, in April, and then May and June, it's a good flow of baby skunks then. Yeah.
Okay. So you get a litter of baby skunks. Mm-hmm. And so walk us through your triage. What do you do?
Well, of course, you know, we want to get as much history from the finder as possible, because that'll help us determine, you know, how we're going to proceed and everything. But we want to tell our finders when they're transporting to provide some supplemental heat for these kids. As I mentioned earlier, hypothermia is really a serious situation with them, and they can die quickly from that. So we give people ideas for supplemental heat, such as the hand warmers. You know, you can break open the pack and shake it, multiple of those. Obviously, a heating pad if you have a converter where you can put it in your car and keep it going for the transport time. The heating disc, you know, the warm water bottles or the rice socks, any type of supplemental heat that'll help keep these babies warm or at least warm them up during the transport is crucial for them. And then, of course, you know, we get them in, we're wearing gloves, of course. Again, they're a rabies vector species, so we want to take caution to protect ourselves, you know, of course, with any potential disease spread, but also to protect us from being bit, that kind of thing. And then we're going to, for us, if they are cold, we do have an incubator that we can place our animals in to help warm them up, you know, help with shock, especially. Hypothermia is serious, like I mentioned, and then providing sub-Q fluids. That's another thing that we offer or we do for our patients. And our sub-Q fluids usually have a little bit of B vitamins included with them, and that helps. And then depending on their body condition will dictate what kind of setup they go in from there.
Okay.
If they're just orphaned and they look, you know, fairly healthy, they just need a little bit of sub-Q fluids to get their hydration up, their mucosal membranes look pink and healthy, then we'll start getting them on formula. And with them, we do not dilute their formula in the beginning like you would like neonate possums, right? Because the neonate possums can't take full strength. But with the skunks, they do a little bit better, and we get them usually on 5% of body weight. As closed babies, you know, we're having to syringe feed them. But as open, the good thing about them is they're willing to lap formula, which is nice.
Oh, that makes things a little easier.
Yes.
So I've got, I have a couple questions. So when you do sub-Q or subcutaneous fluids,
yes,
are you giving it in a similar place that you would like a baby squirrel or a baby raccoon? So you're pulling up the skin like between the shoulder blades or along either side of the backbone, not on the backbone, but either side,
right,
and giving a bolus there?
Yes.
Or is there something, anything special about skunks that you need to worry about?
Yeah, with same thing applies for them as well. You know, of course, you never want to give it on the spine,
right,
not on the abdomen or anything like that. Yeah, between the shoulder blades or the back of the rumps on, you know, the side of the hips or whatever.
Right, right. It's usually one time giving them a nice bolus, and there's lots of calculations we can do through the quick reference and stuff like that to kind of help tell you how much you need to give, but it's usually one and done, or it just depends.
It really depends on the severity of that dehydration level, the percentage level of that. You know, we've gotten them in where they've needed, you know, a couple of rounds of sub-Q fluids, but you also don't want to give them too much at one time. So, but normally a good bolus of fluids and vitamins, you can see them perk up very quickly. And of course, their body temperature is also, you know, elevated a little bit more. So, yeah.
Right, right. Okay. And then before we get into, because you jumped right into, which I have lots of questions about formula and all that stuff, but aging. So they're coming into care. You are evaluating, warming them up, fluids. You're doing a full physical exam, making sure that everything is okay and there's no injuries, things
correct,
like that.
Yep.
Maybe taking care of any parasites. We're going to talk about parasites later. Taking care of some of the parasites. Now, you've got to figure out, well, okay, you might be feeding them full strength formula or pretty close right away, but how old are they? So how do you figure that out?
So we've had them in from pinkies, what we call pinkies, where they have no fur whatsoever. A matter of fact, we had an incident this year where a guy had trapped a skunk and she gave birth in the trap. So he had had her for several days and those babies, and it was so bad. First of all, some of them had squeezed through the holes in the trap, and mom was trying to pull them back in because they're really good moms. But bless her heart, she ripped off the arms of some of them trying to get them back in the cage. So when he transported them to us, mom was looking bad because she'd been in the trap a couple of days. There were a couple of deceased babies, and then there were one or two that I had to euthanize. And then we had two that were healthy enough that, you know, we could let her take care of them, which is always great. But they have eyes closed, no fur. Now, they have their stripes on their skin, but no fur. altricial, you know, meaning we got to provide care or mom's got to take care of them. Ears are down. They can't hear, that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And they can range anywhere from, I don't know, like the size of a squirrel or a bunny, between 15 grams to 35 grams when they're first born, right? Okay. And usually, you know, they gain weight quickly, especially if they're being fed by mama, which is interesting because we let her feed them. We just took really good care of her. And mm-hmm. those babies gained weight so fast. It was amazing. So mom's got some nutrients in her body that does a lot better job than what we do as humans feeding these babies.
Right. Well, and their milk, you know, I've looked into milk formulas and things like that. When we are trying to figure out what we should give for milk formulas, mom's milk changes composition over the course of raising those babies. Yeah. And we seldom are able to do that.
Exactly. We cannot mimic Mother Nature.
No, we can't.
We try, but we can't
do it. We try. But, and we're better than we used to be. I mean, I've been around long enough that I was at the end of the era of using, you know, egg and whipped cream and all these things. There were not a lot of commercial diets available. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so just thanks on that. And that story too is,
I know. But anyway, so with that situation, you know, mom took care of those, but I did get some newborns a little bit later on in the season, and you know, we had to feed those, but depending on that size, they do have to have a night feeding if they're newborns. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing you want to keep in mind. Your newborns are being fed every 2 to 3 hours with a night feeding. And then, of course, with their milestones as they gain weight and their eyes open up, as with all animals, their, you know, feedings decrease, right?
Sure. And so, so when they're born, you know, like you said, blind, they're deaf, they're, you mm-hmm. know, all this very altricial, which is perfect description. Mm-hmm. And then when do they open their eyes?
It's usually about 3 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
And then that is when a whole new world starts happening for them and for you as a rehabber, which is great.
Okay. Okay. So we'll talk about that. Yeah. We'll talk about that. A whole new world. I like that. Yeah. Okay. So 2 to 3 weeks, their eyes open, ears are kind of opening about the same time. Are their teeth erupted yet?
Yes. Yes, they do.
Okay. So their teeth have started to erupt.
Yep.
And then I'm assuming they start moving around a little bit more. Yes. They're furred, definitely, but maybe not fluffy.
Yep, exactly. But definitely by your 3 weeks, everybody's eyes should be open. You know, you have some early bloomers and some slower bloomers. But by 3 weeks, everybody's eyes and ears are open and they're mobile. And then that's when attitude can start, which is hilarious to me because they become very vocal animals as well. With you as their caretaker or with their siblings, but they're very vocal, which is interesting. And I love hearing it. So, but it's funny. They start developing their little sassy attitudes, I think, that they have.
Oh, I love it. I love the sass. Mm-hmm. Love the sass. Okay. So 3 weeks, all their eyes are open.
Yes.
Then what other developmental stage, or are there many more besides gaining weight and gaining skills, walking and weaning and things like that?
The interesting thing is that they will start raising their tail at that same time frame, but, you know, back up a week or so earlier and they can start emitting that musk. You're going to smell it anyways, because when they defecate, that is passing their scent glands. And so that scent will excrete a little bit, a little bit into the feces. And so it's going to smell, but actually spraying, they will have the ability to do that at your 3 week mark, but they'll start raising their tail up and letting you know, and start giving those warning signs that, you know, we appreciate.
Wow. And even without mom around, they know what signs to give.
Instinctively. It's amazing. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, cool. That is so cool.
It is.
We'll talk about how you have workarounds or strategies, because you don't want to get sprayed either.
Right.
You know, but I've worked with adult skunks, like they needed to be live trapped out of like a grocery store or something like that. And there's a lot, and you're right, they are very docile and they do not spray unless they absolutely feel that they have to. So working slow around them, using blankets, all that kind of stuff. Just, yeah, I've handled a fair number of adult skunks that way. And I really appreciate that from them, that they know that they have this defense.
Exactly.
So they don't have to be, you know, really aggressive or anything with it, because they've
Have multiple defenses or warning signs. You know, they, and I may be jumping the gun for you,
but okay.
They don't want to spray, right? Mm-hmm. That's their main defense. And so if they spray and they emit all of what they've got because they feel that threatened, it takes them 10 days to build that back up.
So that's good. That's really good to know.
That time frame of 10 days without any like defense to keep the animals or the predation at a distance, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The things they have to rely on then is the stomping of their front feet or the throwing around of their back end to show you their tail, although they may not have anything to squirt out, they're still going to do that because that's natural for them. Skunks have a tendency to also hiss or huff, grunt, that kind of thing. But they will give you ample warning signs before they do the whole spraying because they don't want to deplete all that for them.
Right. So, okay. So they can start doing that at 2 weeks and they start learning those behaviors right away. Do they, I'm thinking not that they don't like spray each other, do they?
No, they don't. Like when they're in rehab at that age, 3 and 4, even 5 weeks of age, you know, they don't typically spray. Even our caretakers, you know, they are accustomed to us to a degree. We don't make loud noises. We don't approach them quickly. And sometimes like when they're playing rough, they may poof, what we call it, and you'll smell it a little bit, or if we startle them, then definitely they'll poof. But full on spray, they don't typically do that. And during exam, you know, making sure everything's good and they're gaining weight, we're weighing them. We still tuck that tail. Even at that early age, we just want to make sure that they just don't get overly excited or stimulated and think that they're being harmed and release that. So we do tuck their tail even at that young age.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another pro tip right there. We'll try to review those at the end.
Yes.
That's a really good one for finders and for in rehabilitation. So, okay. So we talked about, I think we covered all the aging pieces of it. So they come into care and we're going to go over what formulas you are using, but when their eyes are closed, then they are being syringe fed.
Correct.
And they, do you wrap them like in a little burrito kind of style? Do they prefer being a little bit more loose? I know you're probably feeding them where they're on their bellies.
Yes, they're in a plain position.
Right, right.
I mean, a prone position.
So is there anything there that helps you when you are feeding them?
So for me and my techniques and how we've taught the volunteers here is that, you know, we have them on a pillow with their arms stretched out and their back leg stretched out. And we got a syringe, you know, feeding instrument that we're using. And we actually use a forepaws nipple, which looks like, I don't know if y'all know what the forepaws is, but it used to be like the feeding nipple for squirrels years and years ago. And they're hard to find now, but we still utilize those for our baby skunks, especially. But we have that for the nipple that we use on top of the syringe. And we just hold the syringe out in front of them. They will grab it with their little paws and hold on to it. Sometimes they'll need a little bit, but normally they'll just place their paws on the syringe. So I don't use bottles like you do with raccoons. And then, like I said, once they open up their eyes and they're mobile, a shallow lapping dish becomes your best friend with skunks. And so with that, you want to make sure that each individual in the litter has their own lapping dish, because they will do what's called the butt block, and they'll hold the bowl and not let anybody else lap from the same dish. They'll actually lay in it, kind of like groundhogs do. It's kind of funny. They'll lay in it to prevent others from being able to lap. So we want to make sure that each, you know, individual in the litter gets their own lapping dish when they reach that stage.
I love your description of
Not the most technical term, but that's the only way I can describe it.
Hey, man, it was so visual. I knew exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, of course, laying in it. Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Of course
Yeah.
they would.
They get all messy. So you want to make sure you clean their fur very well.
Right. So are you doing, are you cleaning their fur with like cotton balls in like warm water, or how do you do
with
that?
The babies, when we're having to bottle feed per se, you know, syringe feed, but I call it bottle feeding. When we have to stimulate them, eyes closed babies, we stimulate them. And so I use cotton balls or a soft tissue, toilet paper, you know, a Q-tip, but usually a good cotton ball for me works because it absorbs a lot more and they urinate a lot. And then of course they're going to defecate. But when they get older and you want to get all the fur off their face or off of their bellies from laying in the lapping dish, then we just use a warm, wet washcloth, a little bit of Dawn. But usually they're not that bad because I tell you what they love to do also is they'll lick each other. They'll groom each other to get that formula off of them.
Okay.
So they kind of help clean themselves as well. You don't necessarily have to give them a bath. They'll do it.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that when you're feeding the formula, you're feeding about 5% body weight and you're feeding 100% formula.
You know, if they're dehydrated in the beginning, then we'll, you know, give them some electrostats or mix with that and then increase it to 5%, you know. But normally we can get them on 5% pretty quickly as long as they're hydrated.
Okay. So 5% body weight, but you're, so you're, okay, let's say we've got a hydrated baby.
Mm-hmm.
And eyes closed, ears closed, so small. So do you immediately start then with 100% concentration formula, or do you? So you're nodding your head. So you're not going like we normally do with a lot of the small mammals where you're doing half strength and 75% strength and then 100% strength.
Okay. No, we've had good success with getting those nutrients into them fairly quickly. Again, as long as they're healthy and hydrated.
Healthy and hydrated. Yep. Yeah. That's the key.
That's the key. Okay. And really that's with, you know, all of them because they are not having to graduate up to a strength really.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other thing, before we leave the really small babies. So you're feeding every 2 hours. And so you go up until like 10 o'clock at night, 8 o'clock at night.
Well, I mean, honestly, that depends on the caregiver schedule, really. You know, for me, my schedule can be kind of crazy with them. But yeah, I'll go up till 10 o'clock and then I'll get up in the middle of the night and feed as well because they have to have a night feeding.
Right. So one feeding at night and then you're feeding again, starting what, at 6 in the morning, 7 in the morning?
I'm usually between 5:30 and 6.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. And I just want to give people a little bit more guidance because I'm like, okay, well, what does that mean? Every two hours until when? So I can figure out that one night feeding instead of having to feed every 2 hours, which is, you know, it's like, okay, every 2 hours, you're going to be feeding around the clock. But okay. And then when their eyes open, do you go more by weight when you're going to reduce some of the feedings, like eliminate the night feeding, for example?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
A consistent weight gain. And I weigh, like some people weigh daily. I don't weigh daily. And I'm being honest, you know, 2 to 3 days for newborns, I'm weighing them. And if they got a consistent weight gain at each of those increments, then we'll start decreasing. Eyes open for sure. They then decreased formulas. So instead of, you know, say 6 feedings a day with a night feed, you're going to 5 to 4 and then 4 to 3 feedings. So it reduces as those weight gains happen on a regular basis.
Okay. 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 So that's helpful. And so eyes open, you're reducing some of the feedings. Do you right away introduce that little lap bowl that you were talking about?
For eyes open, yeah. I mean, you know, good. When I mean by eyes open, I don't mean they're like barely cracked and they're trying to get their vision. I mean, like they're full on eyes open. They're mobile. They recognize each other just by sight or with us, you know, coming into the room to feed them. But yeah, we can get them on a lapping dish fairly quickly, which I love. It helps make things a lot easier for them and for us as well.
So you're cleaning that frequently. So every time you go in to feed, they're getting a new lapping dish. And
they do. We do clean our lapping dishes after each use. We don't like to leave lapping dishes with old formula. For us, it gets hot here in North Carolina, and it can get nasty, and so we don't want bacteria developing and that kind of stuff. But after every use, we wash our dishes. And for me, I'm a little anal about it, but I like to give them back the same lapping dish they had.
Okay. Well, that's okay. It probably still smells a little like them. So how do you keep that straight then?
It's not that it smells like them because it's being washed, but if they're already accustomed to a certain dish, then why change it up for them, right?
Right. So what kind of dishes are you using?
So we love small, shallow ashtrays, if you can still find those, that don't have like a deep ridge. We also use the, what do you call those? Not a souffle dish because that's too deep, but it's very similar to that. I can always send you a link to it. But it looks like a large ashtray. It's probably half an inch in depth or height. A good way to describe it is, what your small planter saucers are for your
pots? Yep.
The small version of those. That's
okay.
Okay.
You're filling it. You're putting partway in there as far as formula. I mean, is that part?
To get them trained, you mean? So once we introduce the lapping dish, we'll slowly, plunge the syringe and push it into the lapping dish. And they'll usually start lapping pretty quickly. They smell it, they lap it, and then we'll just push the whole amount in there.
That's good that you mentioned that you're training them a little bit to it. So it's not just put in their enclosure and they explore and they figure it out. They probably would, but that's probably more efficient just to train them.
We monitor also to make sure no one's aspirating, like inhaling through their nose, right?
Right.
So that's a key thing for them as well, is aspiration pneumonia. You want to prevent that. So no, we don't just throw it in there and wish them luck. We actually monitor and sit with them to make sure everybody's one getting their own and not bullying anybody out of their bowls, because there's always going to be someone in the litter that's a little bulkier than the rest because they want to dominate the food bowls. So we make sure everybody gets their own and they're lapping well. And normally they'll go off by this time and they'll find a corner they like, and that's where they'll use the bathroom. So they will litter box train, which is good.
That's good. That makes life a lot easier in a lot of ways.
It does. But the litter boxes have to be changed very often because they defecate so much. But the fact that it's in a litter box, it makes it a lot easier. And we use the pine pellets, which is, good. It's not going to harm them, put it like that.
Okay. Back to syringe feeding. I just had a thought or a question. Do they feed kind of like cottontail rabbits, which can be very, very picky and very slow, or do they feed like raccoons or baby squirrels who, once they've got the hang of it, try to inhale the food? Or are they someplace in between?
I think there's someplace in between. Like I said, I've done small babies, like newborns, and once they latch on, they're pretty steady about it. They're not the fast inhalers like your squirrels. They're not crazy like the raccoons and lose their minds. They don't scream, thank goodness, like the baby raccoons. But they get a slow, steady pace. And you can, like with the squirrels, you can feel that rhythm that they get. And so you know how fast to plunge it with that rhythm that they establish themselves. Mm-hmm. But I'd say they're a steady eater, I would say. They don't like their formula really hot. They don't like hot formula, but a good warm temperature, because they don't like it if it's cool either. So there's a happy medium for them with that temperature as well.
What do you use to keep it warm? I mean, do you have like a coffee warmer? Do you use one of those baby warmers?
Well,
the formula warm.
Everybody has their own system, but we have a tea kettle where we just warm up hot water. Mm-hmm. And then put it in the coffee mug, and then we put our syringes in there. And by the time we get to the rehab room, it's at a pretty good temperature. And so we don't actually keep it on a cup or anything, because it's usually already given to them by that time.
Okay. Another question about caretakers. Are skunks the kind of animals that And with the caveat that I know that consistent care by one caregiver generally works better because the babies get, they understand that caregiver. Mm-hmm. But is it like that where it's like, I'm going to assign one caregiver and that's the person that takes care of those? Or is it different? How do you do that?
For us and how we do it here, the eyes closed babies are definitely by one person, one individual that's okay. feeding them. That's with the bottle feedings. But as they are older and they're lapping, then everybody can feed them, like, because okay. they're just putting formula in the lapping dish or giving okay. them their goodie bowls, as we call them, and changing out their litter boxes, that kind of stuff. Okay. So when their eyes are open and they're able to lap, then others can participate in feeding them. But with eyes closed, it's one individual.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Which puts certainly a little bit more strain on the system, probably. But yeah. A lot of animals
it
tend to
really
do.
Depends on how many there are, really. Mm-hmm. But I typically do the eyes closed babies, and it's not any more for me because they eat good. And, you know, I don't think they're nearly as stressful as, say, squirrels are, because squirrels okay. just lose their mind and want to inhale it, you know.
Right. Oh, right. Exactly. And, yeah. and do you find the babies since you mentioned stress, or distress, you know how young rabbits they're very much the quintessential prey animal, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You look at them wrong and they're having difficulties. But are skunks like that, or are they?
No, they're not as fragile as the
bunnies
are. Okay. I'd say they're a happy medium as well. They're pretty tough kids, honestly.
Okay. Okay.
As long as they're warm and they've got good bellies, you know, full bellies, they're pretty hardy kids. But the bunnies, man, you can look at them wrong sometimes and they'll just fall over. But I love rehabbing bunnies too. So I'm the weird one.
I don't think it's weird at all. I think you're in great company, by the way.
Oh, good.
A lot of our listeners are you're in good, good company.
Good to hear.
Let's go ahead and talk maybe about formula. So what milk are you using?
So honestly, when I first started rehabbing skunks, I would use the Espalac. And the formulas have changed over the years, of course, and the manufacturers, you know, change ingredients and stuff. And then I started using the goat milk Espalac. And then there came the Fox Valley skunk formula. So that's what the Fox Valley, the latter, is what I used this past year and had good success and didn't have any problems. We had some incidents with other animals with some of the formula ingredients, formularies being changed, that we had some problems with some of the species. But this year we did the Fox Valley skunk mm-hmm. variation, and they did all fine.
Oh, good. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So Fox Valley. So would be a recommendation, at least for this year, right? I mean,
again, you know, as long as these formulas, you know, stay consistent in how they're being made and we're being told ahead of time that things are being changed with them, you know, the others can do fine as well. It's, you know, if that's what you have available. If goat's milk Espalac is what you have available, then that's what you got, right? And you can make that work as well. It does fine. But when the ingredients or something about those formulations are being changed and you got diarrhea going on, then you got to find something else that's going to work for them. So,
right, right.
Our success right. was this year with Fox Valley.
Okay. Okay. Another supplement or something that I was reading about is with skunks to add taurine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, so the taurine is, you know, an amino acid that helps in the development of muscle function, especially the brain and the heart function. And so we need to get that into these kids early so that they don't develop cardiomyopathy, right? You want that heart pumping, and the heart's a muscle. It's a big muscle. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that that's pumping correctly. So we do add additional taurine to the babies early on, but once they start getting their solid foods, like their meat items, because this is where it's found, and it's in your animal proteins, and they'll get that. But if they're not getting that type of natural food item, then they're going to need some help with that early on. And we also, so we provide the taurine supplement that's put into their formula, but we also will use puppy missing link, which is a supplement you sprinkle onto foods. And we put that on their like goodie bowls. What I call goodie bowls is their solid foods. It's a combination of different things. We'll sprinkle that on there as well, just to provide that extra, you know, extra oomph if they're not getting a lot of meat items.
And you call that was puppy missing link. Who
missing
produces
link.
That?
And we get that off of Amazon.
Amazon. But who's the manufacturer? Is it like Purina?
Missing link. You know, that's a good question. The brand name is just Missing Link, but I've never looked to see who that.
Okay. I mean, it might be just Missing Link.
Yeah, I think it is just Missing Link. Now, they did have different varieties. There's Missing Link Hip and Joints. There's Missing Link Skin and Coat. There's Missing Link Puppy and Feline, but we use the puppy.
The puppy. And link. Yeah, and I'm looking it up. Google.
Oh,
you
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
And it is. That's the name of the company is The Missing Link.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, yep. There you go. So you can find it off of, it was on Chewy, but Amazon, or I'm sure that there's other commercial places you can get it. Okay. How much for, so the Missing Link, you would sprinkle on their goodie bowl, which we'll talk about in a minute, just every day or every time you feed them.
Yes.
With a new, fresh one. The taurine, do you have a like amount you give, and you're giving it at every feeding? And you obviously correct me, every feeding until their eyes open, and you and maybe a little bit past that until they start getting, they're getting weaned.
Yes, yes. And they're starting to get more of those natural food items that's going to have the animal protein. And we provide really good, high quality animal protein. So if you want to jump to some of the solid foods that we give, we can do that.
Yeah, we can do that in just a second. So taurine, do you like have a recommendation for?
So the taurine that we have, it has a little, I think it's a quarter of a teaspoon, you know, in the actual container.
Oh, a little scoop thing.
Yeah, a little scoop thing. So that's what we use. And I put that in with, say, a pint of formula. So it's not a whole lot that you're using. So I'll make the batch of formula up, or we'll make the batch of formula up, put that in it. And then it's distributed throughout with each feeding.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not, we don't do a new batch of formula at every feeding. We make a batch, you know, for the day. And it's got that in it, just like with, you know, if colostrum is added for other species and stuff, but, it's not a substantial amount. And then we administer it through their feedings or if they're lapping. And then as they get older, it's sprinkled. The missing link is sprinkled on the other items.
Okay. I love it. Okay. But let's jump to the goodie bowl.
Yeah. So we call, you know, so they have their staple of formula, and then we give a goodie bowl in the evenings. And we also provide, and it can be controversial, depends on which rehabbers you're talking to, because everybody has their own way of doing things. But for us, we also, when they're starting to wean from the formula, we'll give them some soak, what we call kibble, or it's called exclusive PMI cat food, chicken and brown rice cat food. But it also contains taurine in it. That's another reason we use that. And you can also use ferret pellets. Ferret food, sometimes it's hit or miss. I've had some that really like it, and I've had some that are like, no, I'll pick around it and leave that. So, you know, you can try both of those. The Missouri brand of skunk food is good. Skunk pellets is good. But the, you know, the cat food is controversial with some people. They're like, oh, it's too much fat or too much protein. But it's a really high quality cat food, and it's chicken and brown rice, but it also contains taurine. So that's one of the reasons we use it as well. But it has a good ratio for the fat and protein. It's not crazy, like some of your, you know, cheaper brands may be. But anyway, so we provide that when, you know, we soak those items, let it be the skunk food or the ferret pellets or the PMI. Cat chow will soak that to make it a little bit softer for them, because remember, their teeth are just now erupting and they're not going to be able to chew hard food. So we make it soft for them. So they have that as well. But our goodie bowls will consist of a whole array of things. But to get their vegetables in, we spoil them by making what's called a veggie slaw. And that's where we throw a whole array of vegetables into our blender. And it's sweet potato and kale or broccoli, all the squashes that we can throw in, apples, sometimes pumpkin, you know, a whole array of vegetables. We throw it into the blender and chop it up like slaw. That way they can't pick out their favorites.
That is a great pro tip, by the way.
They really like it. And then we'll throw in their skunk pellets. So there's another skunk pellet brand. I think it's by Exotic Nutrition, I think is who makes it. Mm-hmm. But we'll mix the veggie slaw up with that. And that way they get their vegetables, you know, get all the good minerals and nutrients that they're needing. And then we'll start adding in scrambled eggs with eggshell to get that calcium, or even hard-boiled eggs. We'll throw in like the high-quality meats that we use. We have the mice, of course, like pinky mice, or we'll cut up, you know, day-old mice or whatever. We also provide canned rabbit. We provide raw meats, processed raw meats. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with Darwin's. It's an expensive brand, but it's a good quality brand that we use to give them turkey. We give them a whole array of things that they can not just have one thing and get bored with their diet. We like to mix it up. We provide mealworms, live mealworms, or we provide soldier fly larvae. And there's a great for calcium as well. We'll mix those in with their veggie slaw. They do like cottage cheese. That's a good calcium product.
Sounds like it's a whole wide variety, and variety, of course, is the spice of life.
Yeah, mm-hmm. If you're providing a good diet, then you're going to have good development of your bone density, right? We don't want MBD to develop or brittle bone, because that can happen just as with the other species. So we want to make sure they're getting all those essential nutrients, and so they can have good bone development, good nerve development, good muscle growth. All those things are essential in making sure we got healthy animals. And really, all of our kids are fed like this. We take pride in feeding our kids very well. Mm-hmm. And they cost us a fortune.
Oh, yes. Yes. But, you know, the product, right? The product is a healthy animal.
Exactly.
Released to the wild. So, okay. So I just want to kind of recap a little bit. But with the food, that when you are doing this goodie bowl with all this veggie slaw and all this other stuff, what kind of proportions are you feeding? Are you feeding like half of it's going to be veggie slaw and then a quarter of it's going to be, you know, protein like cut up mice, and a quarter of it is going to be something else? And then they always get there. It's always available for the, you know, the kibble. Will always be available, or how does that look?
So the proportion size, you pretty much nailed that. A majority of the food bowl or goodie bowl is going to be a bulk of vegetables. So I would say 60% of that is going to be your vegetable or vegetation of some matter. Mm-hmm. And then we'll have, you know, a little bit, say 10% of your skunk pellets or your ferret pellets. And then we'll throw in another 10% of, say, mozzarella cheese or a cottage cheese, and then you've got another percentage for your meats. Let it be mice, or let it be rabbit, or the turkey, even raw duck. We have processed duck, and they seem to really like that. Mm-hmm. But, or even our quail eggs. Quail eggs are great for them. We give those to a lot of our animals because it's also something they're going to eat out in the wild, right? They're going to find wild bird eggs, and they're going to eat those. And they'll eat it raw. And so we'll give them that. And with the shell, that's a good calcium source. So that's pretty much the ratio. Is a bulk of it is going to be more of your vegetation matter and your insects, like the crickets, the mealworms, the soldier fly larva. We're not throwing the whole steak at them by no means.
Okay. So now when do you fully wean them? How old are they about?
8 weeks, they're usually weaned, at least with mom. And, you know, if depending on their condition when they come in, we may extend that a little bit, but they're at least off the formula by 8 to 10 weeks max. And then they're on a solid for the rest of the time, which is the kibble in the morning, and then their goodie bowls at night.
And goodie bowls at night. Okay.
And they will devour their goodie bowls at night. They're really good eaters typically.
Okay. Excellent. Back to stimulating them. Are they similar to other mammals that when their eyes and stuff open up, you have to stimulate them less and less?
Yes.
Okay.
So with these guys, eyes open and they're mobile, they're already using the bathroom on their own. And they will actually find a corner in wherever you have them in their enclosure, and they'll pick where they're going to use the bathroom. You have to put the litter box where they use the bathroom. So,
And do they all want to use the same corner?
yeah, usually they do.
Awesome. Awesome. So that does make your life
It
just a
makes it
little
easier.
easier.
Yeah, there may be one that may stray over and like, no, I'm going to do it here. But usually, once one starts picking it, they'll smell it and they'll congregate and all use it. It's kind of like a latrine with your raccoons.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So raccoons are pretty easy to litter train too, litter box train, which is nice. Okay. So we have kind of a good timeline on when they're in care and when they get weaned. And so when do you release them?
So for us, we have a graduating process for our enclosures. So when they're babies, we have them in either like a small bin or a flip top. And then they'll graduate up to rabbit cages, large rabbit cages. And we are fortunate enough to have barn stalls that we can use for our kids indoors. So if we have large litters, we can give them the barn stall. And then once they're weaned, they don't go outside to the pre-release cages because we do soft release for our animals. But they don't go outside until they're off the formula. And then they'll go into a pre-release cage, which for us are modified chicken coops, and use those for the skunks. And then they'll go outside. They'll be acclimated to the outdoor elements and all the animals around them. And then usually 2 weeks they're released. So, 12 to 14 weeks, they are pretty much out the door.
Okay. Are you, and you said you soft release, which is for folks listening, is just a slow release method where they can come and go get supported by food. I mean, there's lots of different levels of that, but versus a hard release where you just put them out in a place and say, okay, see you later, good luck. So that's kind of the difference. But
So for us, we're fortunate enough that we're on 105 acres.
okay.
And so we are in a mainly forested area. All of that's pretty much forested except for like 14 acres maybe. But our pre-release cages are out in the woods. And like I said, they can acclimate to the outdoor elements and the animals that already exist on the property, because they can come and go as they please. And we have a main entry door where we enter in to do their, cage cleanup and feeding and so forth. And then there's a smaller door that's, more ground level, I would say. We open that up for them. And 9 times out of 10 with skunks, they don't waste time leaving. Like the first night that door's open, they usually leave. Whereas some with your other animals, they may take their time on leaving. And for the most part, they don't come back. Now, there has been an incident where there's been one that came back around, or I don't know where she got it from, but she had a glue trap on her foot. So she had to
Oh.
go a distance to a subdivision to get that on her foot. But she came back, and luckily she was near that cage. So I was able to get that off her foot. But normally the skunks don't stick around. Some animals that'll linger and want to take their time on leaving the cage,
Sure.
but they do not by no means.
Okay. So usually how long does it take to completely soft release them?
They are gone 14 to 16 weeks. They are completely gone.
Okay. And releasing on your property really helps alleviate, because one of my questions is, how do you find release sites for an animal like this, which can cause
And
challenges?
for us in North Carolina, for the RVS rules, you have to either release the RVS animal either in the county that they came from, when they first found them, or the county where you rehab. So you're limited on where you can release these animals.
Okay.
But for us, you know, like I said, we're fortunate enough to be on 105 acres with some acreage still around us, but a lot of it is being developed, which is unfortunate.
Right, right. It's just,
and so
yeah,
they, you know,
difficult.
Being nomadic, they're going to wander off and they're going to venture into these subdivisions that's being built and so forth. But for release purposes, we have deciduous forest, riparian forest with streams and ponds. And so, you know, it's a good start for them once they leave.
Sure, sure. About how big are they, full size at that point? Or are they three-quarter size?
Yeah, about 3 months. They're about, you know, full size. And for the striped skunks, you know, your spotted skunks are much smaller, but your striped skunks, you know, full adult size is between 5 and 15 pounds, honestly. It's like a small cat. But they look like full-on adults. And that would be the case even if they were with mom in the wild. They're going to be close to about her size as well once they are on their own.
On their own. When you are feeding them in that pre-release, are you still feeding them a lot the same things? Do you change a little bit?
We change it up. You know, we try not to give a repetitive diet because they become bored with it. You know, out in the wild, they're eating a whole array of things. So even like when we're walking out in the woods, we'll pick up some lichen or we'll pick up some mushrooms and throw in there, just to give them diverse bugs, different types of bugs that we find. Plus the bottom of their cage, it's wired, but on top of that is dirt and mulch and leaves. So they're able to forage in that outdoor enclosure as well and find things. But for us, the feeding staples are still going to be their pellets of some sort or chow. And then at night, they get a goodie bowl with some sort of sardines or, you know, clams. We just start throwing a whole array, different array of items for them to take advantage of.
I love it. It stretches you too, as like, what else can we do?
Yeah,
what else can we give and keep you?
That's part of the fun things is, you know, sometimes we'll do enrichment, you know, and hide food items, you know, which is great out in the wild because it may not stink up, you know, like it does your rehab room as much if they don't find it or don't eat it all at once. But yeah, I think it's important to give them a whole variety because that's what they're going to have out in the wild. If you just give them one thing and they become accustomed to that, then they're not going to really know what they should be eating out in the wild. And these kids are not usually picky eaters, right? So you get some animals in there like, no, I don't like that. But they're really good eaters. So we'll give them a whole variety to choose from. It rotates. The menu rotates daily.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm going to go back to when they're a little bit younger.
Okay.
And make sure that I understand, you know, when you are stimulating when they're a little older and their scent glands are fully formed, but they're still not quite peeing and pooping on their own. You were talking earlier about tucking tail or tucking their tail. So
so when their eyes closed, is that what you're talking about? Eyes closed?
Yeah. Yeah.
Eyes closed, they're not going to spray you.
Okay.
They're not, eight days, 10 days, then they're going to start having that musk that can be emitted.
Okay.
But eyes closed babies, you don't have to worry about that. So, you know, a simple cotton ball, you know, over their genitalia, they use the bathroom and it's done deal.
Okay. So it's very, very similar. I just want to make sure I've got that clear in my head.
Yeah. No, they're not going to spray you by stimulating them when their eyes closed by no means. No.
Okay. And then I wanted to go back and talk a little bit more in detail with the enclosures that you use.
Okay.
So you said when they're very small, you're using a bin. Is that a plastic bin? Is that what is that?
So we have a couple of things that we use. I don't know if you're familiar with the flip tops or the critter cage. It looks like a little briefcase and it's got openings on the top, like a wire opening on the top and slits on the side. We use that, but we also use plastic bins that's ventilated with holes in them. If they're really small and they're in the incubator, then they're just in an incubator, right? We've got soft padding down in the incubator, nice bedding to curl up in, and that kind of stuff. But if we're putting them in a bin of some sort, then it's usually a flip top and it's or a plastic bin that's ventilated.
Okay.
And those are on heating pads, of course, right? Remember, you got to help them. They can't thermoregulate their body temperature. So those need to be on a heating pad so that they stay warm.
Okay. So heating pad, and then you're putting in cloth or towels that don't have a lot of things that they can get their little claws stuck in.
Baby blankets or fleece blankets. We don't give anything with cotton loops, you know, like towels and stuff like that.
Okay. Excellent. So now they've graduated. Now their eyes are open. You're about to start giving little lap bowls with milk. And so what does that enclosure look like?
So we've upgraded them to a large rabbit cages. That's the good thing about those, is that you can take off that wire cage and set up enrichment for them, a little hidey box. They like to hide. They'll all congregate in a little hide box and sleep together. But it's got the floor of it will have some pee pads, and we use reusable pee pads that you can wash over and over. Just to keep the landfill, you know, from accumulating more stuff. But we use rewashable pee pads, and we line the bottom with that. And then if we want to put a towel on top of that, it's normally what goes on top of those. And then they have their litter box in one corner, and then they've got their hide box. They've got a couple of toys, you know, that will make noise, or little balls and stuff to play with, because they do play with items. They'll roll around with little stuffed animals and wrestle with those. They wrestle with each other a lot. But, you know, we do give them those to play with as well. And then, of course, in the middle or on one of those sides is where we place a water dish. At this time, you can definitely give them a shallow water dish, and they'll start lapping that water. And that helps them in, you know, staying hydrated as well. And they drink a lot of water, surprisingly. But making sure they have a good water bowl available to them that's not too deep, shallow enough for them to lap from. And then their kibble bowl. And then at night, they'll have their goodie bowl.
Okay. And then you're cleaning all the time, but I would imagine the bigger cleaning is right away in the morning.
Our morning shift is always a hot mess because we're having to clean a lot. And then, of course, we scoop litter throughout the day because it never fails. Every time they eat, they're going and peeing and pooping. So we want to make sure that we keep that smell down and make sure that we're not attracting any type of bugs like flies and stuff. Good hygiene is very key for all of our wildlife, but especially those guys. And groundhogs, their poop smells too. So we do the same thing with our groundhogs as well. But that's one of the enclosures that we use for our kids. And then as they get bigger, like I said, we have a barn stall that we can utilize for large litters. It's a 12 by 12 barn stall. So that's a good
one. I was going to ask. Yep. Yeah. And it's solid on the sides. And skunks, are they much climbers?
They can climb. Our barn stall floor used to be gravel, but we learned the hard way with the groundhogs that didn't work. So our floors in the barn stall are now concrete, so they can't dig out. But they're full barn stall doors or walls and doors. So they cannot climb out because it's slick. But, you know, they can climb out in the wild. And you know, that's the cool thing about the spotted skunks. You'll find them up in broken snags because they'll use the cavity of trees to sleep in.
Okay.
But your striped skunks, not necessarily. But, yes, they can climb fences and stuff like that.
Okay. Yeah. And you said that barn stall is in a barn, so they're fairly protected with everything. So then when they graduate then to the pre-release cage, you mentioned it's wire at the bottom, but you've got several inches of bark and things like that.
So the ground layer is a combination of different substrate, like leaves, mulch, dirt. So they've got that innate, you know, ability to dig, right? They're diggers. So that gives them the opportunity to find food that they're going to eat out in the wild on their own. They'll be able to start creating their own little litter box or latrine, but we still provide a litter box out in those enclosures as well. Sometimes they'll continue using them, but sometimes they'll get a little stubborn, like, no, I want to do it in this corner, or, you know, which I don't understand, but for whatever reason, when they go out in the pre-release cage outside, we have to provide multiple litter boxes.
Good to know. What is the size of that pre-release cage?
So the large one that we use is an 16 by 5, I believe it is. Maybe 6 by 16. or 5 by 16. Honestly,
okay.
I can't remember having a brain fart on that, but it's a good size. It's not small by no means. And so for that size of a cage, we would probably have, you know, 4 in that.
Okay. And the sides, is it all mesh? Is it
so
wood?
The side,
what is it?
The sides are chicken wire,
okay.
a 1/2 inch by 1/2 inch hardware wire.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it has a full on roof, which is consist of, wood, and then a metal roof on top of that.
Okay.
So
mm-hmm.
they are enclosed. They're not just subjected to an open roof by no means.
Okay.
And
okay.
we provide hide boxes or hollow logs or big culvert piping
Oh, yep.
that they can dig in or hide in rather, and sleep in, that kind of stuff. So we provide them more hide spots outside as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, excellent. Okay. Oh, well, one of the things, and we can certainly add to that if you're thinking more pieces and parts of like enclosures and things that are critical, like more latrines, more litter boxes in the outdoor
yeah. And so
cage.
When we move them to their outdoor cage, we take their existing litter box that they had inside out there because it's already got their same scent.
Yep, that makes sense. That
yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah.
Make your job a little easier and them easier to find it.
Exactly.
What I wanted to talk briefly about diseases and parasites and any of it possibly zoonotic. We know about rabies, of course, but any of those kinds of considerations that throughout the entire rehab process for skunks.
For us, of course, the rabies is always at the forefront of our head, but it is mandatory. If you're going to be an RVS rehabber in North Carolina, you have to be vaccinated, which is great. That was part of the rules and regulations that must be. I think it should be, and I'm glad it is there. You know, we're using gloves, of course, but the number one thing that's killing our, I think I mentioned this earlier, killing our skunks and a lot of our RVS is canine distemper.
Right.
So we did a little study on our own, whereas we sent off any of our raccoons that had to be euthanized or died in care for to have necropsies and seeing what their you know, situations were. There were, oh, I think 57 of them, and I think 5 or 6 came back positive for rabies, but over half of them came back canine distemper.
Wow.
So that speaks volumes. Now, fast forward to where the state started collecting specimens from us, and they took, I think at one time it was 22 species from us, and that consisted of fox, skunks, and raccoons that, again, either died in care or we had to humanely euthanize and submitted them, and none of them came back with rabies, but 17 of the 22 came back with canine distemper.
Wow.
Yeah. So for us, before we release these animals or even before they go into their pre-release cages, they are vaccinated against rabies. We provide a 3-year vaccine. So, you know, for us, we want to provide them that shield of protection to get their start on life when they leave us. And I think that's a good way to do that. Plus, if they do encounter a human, they're less likely, you know, to be spreading any diseases. And then canine distemper, to the vaccine for them, we have found is it does work, but it also does not work. Unfortunately, there's been a couple of cases where they have gotten the virus from vaccine induction. You know, you gave the vaccine and it gave them the virus, which, or not necessarily the virus, but some neurological complications. So I found that the best vaccine for distemper is the ferret vaccine for them. And it is more expensive, but I think you'll have more success with that. But we do give a three-year rabies vaccine for them before they're released back into the wild.
One of the things I just want to kind of bring up or make sure everybody knows is that you certainly worked with your veterinarian on trying to figure all this stuff
Absolutely.
Out
yes.
On what to do. And as far as I know, and definitely correct me if I'm incorrect here, is that, you know, the rabies vaccine you know, we know how it works on domestic animals,
right?
But we don't always know how it works with wildlife.
Correct. Yes.
Just so you know that. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. And we do work closely with the veterinarian. We do have a veterinarian in-house, and we work closely with her all the time about the changing of vaccines, the type of vaccines.
Or if to vaccinate or not. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And she and I go, we spend a lot of time on that together. We work closely on those things. And she and I will brainstorm on a regular basis about vaccines. The rabies is not as so much going back and forth as the Stemper vaccine that we have to, you know, do more research into and brainstorm about. And like you said, there's not enough information out there on what's most effective for the wildlife, because it's considered off label, right? These vaccines are made for feline and canine, not wildlife. But we have found, and several people, you know, over the years have been using this stuff, and the research is being done, but it's just not as readily available out there, or not enough of it is done to know what's the best. But I do know that we've had good success with the rabies, haven't had any problems from that, but the different canine distemper vaccine, we've had some issues. The ferret is the best way to go for skunks. Again, it's more expensive, but it's definitely the best option.
How many weeks before release are you vaccinating them? Because I'm assuming that you're seeing the challenges with the distemper before release, because once they're released, you're not tagging any of these animals.
Right. So we release before they go out into that pre-release cage I mentioned earlier. So they get that before they go out there, because they're going to come in contact with wildlife that's already existing out there, right? Not necessarily direct, but, you know, definitely indirect contact, inhalation from air or whatever. But yes, so our kids are vaccinated before they go into the pre-release cage.
Okay. Are there other, like, parasites? Let's talk parasites.
Yeah.
A little bit. So what kinds of parasites do you see with skunks?
For adults, skunks, babies. Typically on intake, especially the adults, is we're going to have ticks and we're going to have fleas. We may have mange and mites of sorts. We've had chewing lice come in, but ticks are the number one culprit we see on these guys, and fleas, of course. So we do treat for that. We'll give them selamectin, which is a brand name would be Revolution. So we give that to them as well. And they also get that in care, and get that before they go outside as well.
Okay.
And then we treat for internal parasites, which the Revolution helps with the roundworms. But we also treat for other, internal parasites, hook, whip, and those kinds of things. And we use fenbendazole, brand name would be like Panacure, or astringents, the pyrantel, Pamate, however you pronounce that.
Right.
We use that, and it's really liked because it's a butterscotch flavor. So it's received well, and the Panacure not so much because it tastes like a bitter chalk. But we definitely give those to help with any type of GI worms that may be going on, or other, you know, internal worms that are going on.
With so like with raccoons, of course, you get them in and you start raising them and you start worming them, and then you continue to worm them every other week or whatever the schedule is.
Yeah.
Do you do that with skunks too?
Usually with the skunks, it's more like every 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
And for us, you know, we do fecal tests. We have that ability in-house. So we'll run those, you know, randomly. If there's a big litter, we'll pick one or two and check those out. And then, of course, if you see anything visual, like tapeworm, then we'll give praziquantel, and we treat everybody. If there's a litter, we treat everybody, not just, because you don't know whose poop is what.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they're sharing a lot of different things, including parasites. Yeah. Yes, isn't it lovely? Yeah. Do you see challenges? This would probably be with adults, not with youngsters. Being that they're on the ground and they're opportunistic and things like that, do you ever get lead toxicity?
Honestly, we have not seen that, or at least when we've tested, we have not. Now, this past year, we didn't get to test as much because our lead machine, the button that uses that, expired. That's a whole different story. But when we had tested in the past, we had not seen that a lot. Now, other states may have, but I cannot say that we have.
Okay.
Our symptoms have been more of a distemper symptom versus lead toxicity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how about with, so I'm kind of jumping back and forth between toxicities and diseases, but have you seen much in the way of avian influenza?
Not necessarily in the skunks. I've been questioning that with a couple of bats that came in this past year, but not the skunks. We've had more rodenticide than we had lead, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then I think there's been some question of some sort of toxicity from herbicide spray. That's another thing that mm-hmm. has come to our questioning of, you know, symptoms and stuff. So, you know, when we talk about educating the public, we talk about them decreasing the chemical use as well, because it does have an impact on the wildlife. Just on, you know, the mosquitoes that they don't want, but that's, you know, create or decreasing food sources for these animals as well. So,
right. Right.
Herbicide and pesticide spray.
Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anytime you have the side at the end of the word,
exactly.
It's toxic.
Yeah,
and usually not to just the thing that you want to get rid of.
Right.
I have one more question about babies. Well, I have lots of questions, but one more main question about babies. And then I want to talk about briefly about things you have to be careful of while they're in care. And I'll explain that in just a second. But when you have a singleton come in,
mm-hmm.
what do you do? Do you put them in right away if you've got another litter? Or, I mean, how does that work?
So we go through a quarantine process. For me, I love the golden rule of 3 weeks, but you can't always do that. 2 weeks mm-hmm. is the bare minimum. But if we can go longer, that's great. But I will say that single babies can habituate. And so mm-hmm. we want to make sure we get them in with others. Now, we try not to mix litters. Like, we get a, you know, a couple litters of 3 or 4 or 5. We don't combo those, right? Mm-hmm. But if we got a single and another single and there's, you know, some time apart, you know, quarantine time, and then we'll introduce those together. Normally, you want to raise those with others, because they're, think about it, in the wild, they're not by themselves. They're always right. with mom and their siblings. So the same thing needs to apply when they're in rehab. So for us, you know, we want to make sure we get others in or place them with others. And very seldom do we don't really have that problem a whole lot. There was one occasion that there was a single, and definitely habituation was happening, but once they get with others, that decreases. And I'll say that once they go in their pre-release cage, and even beforehand, they start wilding up, as you say, per se,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to be around humans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, babies, when their eyes first start opening up and they're playful and they're cute and all, but as they get older, that instinct also increases as well, of having that fear of humans and warning us.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time they're in their pre-release cage, they're definitely letting us know, hey, I'm tired of you and I want to be out in the wild. So, and that happens with all of them. If, you know, the whole litter starts behaving that way. But if you got a single, they were like, oh, here comes mom with some food and I want to play, that kind of thing. No, we don't want to do that.
Right, right.
So getting them with others is key. And that's with, you know, with all our species, really.
Right. Oh, exactly. Conspecifics is the way to go.
Yeah,
but I was going to ask, is that one of the challenges, is it habituation where you have, you know, a young skunk that is just not wilding up? Or is it pretty much, if you've got a singleton, we want to make sure they get in with somebody else, and then we don't have that issue at all?
So we haven't encountered that a whole lot. We had one instance this year where it was a juvenile skunk that came in from, we're not sure if it was a dog attack or hit by a car, but he has some spinal trauma. And mm-hmm. when he came in, his back legs and his tails were flaccid. They didn't work. But he did recover and they started functioning good, but they weren't 100%. And that's mm-hmm. one of the things I was going to share as a tip, is that when you get these skunks in, especially older, they need to have 4 functioning legs. And a lot of times when they come in, they've been hit by cars or dog attacks, they'll have broken bones. And if they mend incorrectly, then it's hard for them to manage the terrain and they got to be able to flee quickly. And if they've got a gimpy leg, they can't quite do that. Or if they're dragging a leg, or if they're not able to bear weight on a foot, then, you know, something has to be talked about up front. And with this particular skunk, he was placed because his legs function, but if he tried to get running very fast, then they would splay out. So he gained use, but they weren't 100%.
Okay.
We had him in care for so long that he become accustomed to us because he was going through so much. We had, you know, physical therapy. We had laser treatment. We did acupuncture with him. And he just had a really great demeanor about himself. Even on intake, he had a good demeanor about himself. Like I said earlier, they're very docile. So unless they feel threatened, they don't spray. But he was a very tolerant patient as well. And usually skunks are. But we just handheld him so much that he just was like, okay, I trust you to do whatever. So he was actually placed with a nature center here locally. And he became an ambassador, an educational animal for them, which is a great option because he had overcome so much. We didn't want to have to euthanize. But if we didn't have that availability, he would not be able to survive in the wild.
Sure.
So for skunks, it's very key that they have four good functioning legs. Now, listen, we've seen raccoons come in and they have three bad legs, but they're still trying to get around. You know what I mean?
Right.
But, you know, the sad situation is that they can't be able to escape predation and dig and get into those dens and burrows like they need to, then they're going to be exposed. So we want to make sure that they have the ability to escape that and do their natural functions.
Right. Right. And that's where, like, I always go back to natural history, right?
Yes.
Is that it's based on natural history and
yeah.
that. And I also think that everything on an animal is used for something.
Yes.
That nothing is wasted.
Right. Yeah.
So, yeah. So you need all four legs.
Yes.
You need, you know, occasionally you can get away with maybe not having a toe,
right.
but you still have to be able to perform the functions that your body is designed to do.
Correct.
In order to survive in the wild.
Yeah.
So,
and a three-legged skunk is not going to survive in the wild.
Right. 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 Do you have any, we've been sprinkling pro tips throughout this whole conversation, which I have found so, oh my God, so engaging and so informative, but do you have any pro tips for folks?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess one thing is, you know, if you do get sprayed, what you need to use to get rid of that.
That's a really good one. I mean, we've been talking about the spray and the smell.
Exactly. And a lot of people automatically want to wash themselves, but water will only enhance that smell. So you don't want to do that. The tomato juice doesn't work. Whatever those other, you know, odd home remedies are, don't work either. But I will say one that is very effective. Is a combination of three ingredients very easily. And you usually have them in your household anyways, which is hydrogen peroxide, baking soda, and Dawn dish detergent, right?
Okay.
So mix all those up together. If you got a small batch, I usually make a big batch because, you know, when you get hit pretty hard, I'm going to make sure I get everything. But
is it equal parts?
No, but it's, I think it's, you can always Google it, but I think it's 1 quart hydrogen peroxide and 1/4 cup of baking soda and maybe a tablespoon of baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely Google that to confirm that. But mix all those ingredients up, lather that up on your arms, in your hair, on your clothes, and then rinse it off, even on your dog. If your dog gets sprayed, don't take in the water hose to him because that's only going to make it worse on him as well. And he'll be smelling like skunk 3 weeks later. But if you use this combination, lather them up really well and then rinse it off, that really does help.
Oh, awesome. Okay.
But and I promise you, I have used that multiple times and it has definitely taken it out of my clothes, taken it out of my hair. But I'm also one of those that I don't mind the smell. It doesn't offend me like a lot of people. I think it kind of smells good in a weird way. But, you know, not everybody appreciates the skunks as much as I do. And I understand that. But I definitely offer that up to people. Yeah.
Oh, I'm really glad you said that. We will make sure that they're in the show notes. The recipe's in the show notes. So it's easy access for people.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't have to say, where did I hear that?
Right?
It's at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
End of the episode. So, man, this has been amazing. Do you have any other either final thoughts, resources. Oh my gosh, you need to check out this resource for skunks, whether it's natural history or whether it's raising them or that kind of thing, or yeah, any last thoughts.
For me, when I first started, I didn't have a lot of guidance with skunks because, for one, they had been illegal for so long that no one even bothered with them, of course. Mm-hmm. But I dive into books and research and papers and all that kind of stuff. You know, I feel certain that most of your rehabbers, if they don't, they should invest in the Wild Mammals baby book. I think it's called like The First 48 Hours and Beyond. It's a great resource. And, you know, when they made that, they did a fantastic job. And I know there's a fourth edition now. I'm not sure exactly what has changed over the time because I only have the third edition, but it has been a great resource for me because, you know, you don't rehab these guys year round, at least the babies, right? You get them in the spring and summer, and then you take a large break without that. So they're like, oh, wait, what? Oh, yeah, let me refresh my memory. But it's an easy go-to, and it covers so many species. But it's a great resource, I think, for skunks as well, because that's really what I use as my reference guides on a lot of the stuff for them, especially the feeding schedule. But I guess for me is for people to appreciate they serve a purpose just like everything else. Mm-hmm. And it's just to extend kindness to all the animals, not just the skunks, but they get such a bad reputation that's really not warranted. And I just wish people would be more compassionate with them, especially, but the wildlife in general. Like I said, they're not aggressive animals. They're, for me as a rehabber, they're a joy for me to rehab. I really do enjoy them. They're not a high stress animal for me. And I think my coworkers fellow coworkers and staff and all them would agree. For me, if I took a poll, I did take a poll actually at our volunteer appreciation day. I asked everybody, what's your favorite species to work with? And 9 times out of 10, they all said possums, right? Everybody loves the possums. There were a couple of raccoon people. I was the only skunk person.
Well, I'm glad you own it.
Yes, I do. I own it proudly. I wear my shirts and everything saying I'm a skunk whisperer or anything. Yeah. But I do love them. And so, you know, I'm not saying that people have to embrace them like I do, but at least extend the respect to them and the compassion that they deserve just as well as any other species out there, because they really are doing good things for our environment and our ecosystems. Right. Just give them the chance to do it and don't think that everything is rabid that you see during the day.
Exactly. Well, Ruby Davis, I cannot thank you enough. I have learned so much about skunks and raising skunks and skunks in general and natural history and everything. So I really appreciate your time. And thank you so much for being on this episode of Wildlife Rehab From Rescue to Release.
Well, I appreciate you asking me. I appreciate you enjoying the first podcast that you heard of me talking about skunks. And I just appreciate your willingness to share more information about them and not only help the public, but the rehabbers as well. And if there's anything I can do to help, you know, your state change that, I'm willing to provide as much information as I can to help expedite that for you guys. But thank you for caring about the wildlife and caring about the skunks as well.
Yes. Yes. Love them all. Love them all. That was my conversation with skunk expert Ruby Davis. Ruby is the Wildlife Rehabilitation Director for Carolina Wildlife Conservation Center. Next episode, I welcome Amanda Nicholson, Senior Vice President of the Wildlife Center of Virginia. She's also a personal friend. We cover the topic, crucial conversations. Many sensitive conversations come up in wildlife rehabilitation. Amanda tells us how she draws on her experience and expertise to navigate these sometimes tough conversations with success. Wildlife Rehabilitation From Rescue to Release is a production of Partners for Wildlife, working hand in hand with wildlife rehabilitators and veterinarians to improve the welfare of orphaned, ill, and injured wildlife. Our executive producer is me, Gail Buell. I'm the Partnership Coordinator for Partners for Wildlife at the University of Minnesota, College of Veterinary Medicine's Raptor Center. To learn more about the Raptor Center and Partners for Wildlife, visit raptor.umn.edu. Our producer is Kirk Clocky. Special thanks to our guest Ruby Davis, Partners for Wildlife, and the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota College of Veterinary Medicine. And that's our show. Hope you'll join us again next time.